This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
It is 5 minutes past nine here on Community in Conversation. I'm Kathy Kayla, and thank you so much for joining me this morning, this Friday morning, the 24th of September. How did we get to this point in the year? By being busy, apparently, and by having lots and lots of conversations. So I wanted to talk to you today about something that's been on my mind. It's also been in the news recently, but it's not the first time. Before I actually tell you what I'm going to be talking about today, I want to tell you that I'm live today. So make a note of the numbers to contact me. We're also going to be taking calls. So I'll give you the studio number as well. If you want to get in touch with me during the show this morning, the number is 061-895-1019. The studio number to call, if you want to come on air and you want to have the conversation and join the conversation between me and my guest, the number is 01-01-40-30-20. Got it? 01-01-40-30-20. The SMS line, you know, we've been doing this for 12 and a half years, is 34519. The text, that's, those texts are charged at 1 rand 50. And you're also welcome to tweet at Chai FM. I will get all of your messages. When crimes in a community are committed by community members, we have a tendency to try and keep it quiet. If we discuss it at all, it's in hushed tones and gossip. We don't discuss it outside of the community. What I am curious about is we treat all crimes as one and the same. Whether it's domestic abuse, paedophilia, rape, or financial crimes, the community tends to sweep it under the carpet, and I'm trying to understand why. You know, you need to acknowledge something before you can address it. So I've asked Chad Thomas to join me. Chad is a high-profile head of high-profile investigations at IRS Forensic Investigations. He's no stranger to Chai FM listeners, and while Chad is well-known to you, you'll also know that I always seek out the best practice experts. So I can go through Chad's resume, but I don't think that that's actually necessary. It's just too long and it'll take half the show. Welcome, Chad. How are you?
How's it, Kathy? It's so nice to be back in studio.
It's lovely to have you here. It feels like real radio again.
It's amazing. It's like being back at home.
Yeah, we're hoping to open up the studios on the 1st of November. Chad, why is crime hidden by communities? Because I don't think that this is something that's unique to the Jewish community.
It's not. So it's so bad that the American SEC, together with the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, created a term specifically for crime that targets communities from within those communities. And we refer to it as an affinity type crime, specifically if it's financially related. We found that these crimes impact so badly on communities that it causes what we call a catastrophic event because it's destructive. It's worse than a hurricane. Families don't speak to other families. Family members within a family stop talking to each other. Friends no longer want to be seen with others. And everybody knows that something's going on, but nobody's quite sure what's happening. And it has a domino effect because something happens and you don't know what's happening. You can't work through it.
100%. So that's quite interesting. I mean, you speak about how people stop speaking. It is very difficult because you could have somebody who, for example, commits a financial crime. The family of that person and the close relatives of that person may not have known about the crime, and yet they are caught in the crosshairs.
So by association, a lot of people are painted with the same brush. But conversely so, a lot of family members or friends that were close to, let's say, a fraudster, for example, may have benefited from the proceeds of that misrepresentation. And they may feel a sense of guilt, a sense of shame, or they may feel that they need to help cover up because they've realized that they've benefited and perhaps they saw the warning signs. Perhaps there were little niggles that said to them, something's not kosher here. Something needs to be looked at, but they didn't follow through with that gut instinct. So there's so many emotions that come with an affinity type fraud, especially involving the families. There's the guilt aspect, we benefited. There's the shame aspect because people may look down on us. And then there's the greatest, and this is the one that they find the hardest to get over. And that's acknowledging that they should have done something sooner and they didn't.
How important is it? Because don't we all have that where we might have like a little niggle, you know, that small still voice And we ignore it because we think, you know what, this person is beyond it. This person cannot be abusing their wife or their children or committing financial crimes. They're such a good person. They give charity, they go to synagogue or they go to church. You know, they're God-fearing. How are we supposed to act with that?
It's a difficult one. When a person has a gut instinct, they need to act on it. We tend to want to suppress those gut instincts. Our human nature, 99% of the warning bells can be going off in our head that something's wrong, but we'll go with the 1% that reassures us that we're overreacting. And there's a reason why we have these warning signs. We are very intuitive as human beings, and we need to look at why these warning signs are there, why we have these niggling doubts, and we need to perform our own investigation. It doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to be right, but at least you've put it to bed, because the worst thing that can possibly happen is 6 months, a year down the line, you say, you know what? I knew it. I should have done something about it, because now it's become your problem. You're going to hold on to that, and you're going to find it very difficult to let go because you think you could have helped or saved others.
How often do spouses know?
A lot of the time. Spouses inherently, if they're not part of a crime that's taking place, they will know that something's wrong. They know what their spouse earns. They know what their lifestyle is about. They know if somebody is staying out late. They know if somebody has a gambling problem. 9 times out of 10, they would know. But there again, they sometimes become used to the new lifestyle. They get used to the perks of whatever it is their spouse is getting up to, or their father's getting up to, or their brother's getting up to, or their sister's getting up to. And this is the sad part, because sometimes you initially want to ignore it. You're opposed to it, and then you just get used to it, and suddenly you're benefiting from it. And before you realize it, you're up to your shoulders in it.
Now, I think of Bernie Madoff. He was making good money, as many of, you know, the Wall Street traders do, and hedge fund managers. That's essentially what he did. His wife would not have had reason to question why they were living the lifestyle that they were. And in all, you know, with... They had, I think it was 3 homes, but they weren't living excessive lifestyles.
So Bernie Madoff is an interesting case. It's the biggest known Ponzi scheme to date.
Yeah, $87 billion, I think.
And when one looks at his history and what he did for the NASDAQ and what he did for the New York Stock Exchange, he came with very good bona fides. It was very difficult for people to comprehend that he had, in fact, committed such a sophisticated, complex Ponzi at the end of the day. So he's more of an exception to the rule. Most of your Ponzi scammers will change their lifestyle within months or years of introducing a new financial scheme. He started something. He was recognized by the financial community as somewhat of a whiz kid. And because of that, people wanted to ignore the warning signs when those warning signs came. So Bernie Madoff is somewhat of a exception to the profile of your typical Ponzi scammer.
And yet it was very much affinity related.
It was, because he stole from his community.
Let's go a little bit more into this affinity scam. Just give a definition of what an affinity, what's it called, an affinity scam?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're investigating one at the moment, and I'm going to be very, very honest. We're going to talk about Jewish families, Muslim families, Christian families, and we're going to be straightforward about it. We had a case called QSG. QSG International, the father and son, the Smiths, were very well known amongst the evangelical Christian community, specifically on the West Rand. They knew the pastors in the different churches, and they introduced a get-rich scheme where you could invest in fuel that would be transported via Dubai and would be used by major organizations. Initially, it started with jet fuel, then it moved across to biofuel. But it was a complete and utter scam. They specifically targeted Christians within those churches, and the pastors themselves were incentivized, and they preached what was called prosperity. Right now I'm working a case of a Muslim family where the daughter of the bride brought her boyfriend to the wedding, and the boyfriend at the wedding sat at a table with the family of his girlfriend, together with the in-laws of the new family that had joined, and spun them stories, and over a year defrauded both families and has caused chaos within these two families. And what made him good, what made him trustworthy was the fact that he was the boyfriend to the daughter of the bride. She made him a good thing inadvertently. She didn't realize it. And because she had heard his stories and believed his stories, she was the one that reassured everybody that it was a worthwhile investment. She's now come clean to us that after a couple of months, she realized he had a serious gambling problem. And she, in fact, started accompanying him to the casinos and knowing that the money he was using had come from her very own family members. And not just that, she had introduced childhood friends to his elaborate scam. And that scam has now collapsed. We've actually listed the individual on our social media, and it's cost these two families millions upon millions of rands. But it's not just the financial impact. You're talking about two families that came together for a wedding. The destruction within the trust of those two families is at an all-time low.
Addictions aside, so let's take away substance abuse and let's take away gambling. What is the motivation? Because no matter how much money you have, you will never be satisfied.
When is enough enough? And there's a lot of people that have
that. What's the motivation for it?
So there's two motivations. The first motivation is people want to have a lifestyle. They want to have the best that money can buy. And they want to be perceived as successful by their peers. Second to that is the personality traits of the individual that's committing the fraud. That person gets off on being able to defraud people. It's almost a thrill to them when they initiate what we call a move or a knock, and that move or that knock comes to fruition and they're able to see that money reflect. So it's twofold. It's lifestyle and it's the sociopath that comes into play.
We've got to take some ads, but as soon as we come back, I want to talk to you, Chad, about should we be discussing this openly in communities. Can we do that?
Looking forward to it.
Awesome.
It's a community in conversation. Join Kathy Kayla every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 High FM.
And I am Kathy Kayla. My guest this morning is Chad Thomas. He's no stranger to High FM. And Chad is the high profile, he handles high profile investigations at IRS Forensic Investigation. So a lot of the investigations that he does is around financial. So if we are focusing on financial, just bear in mind that that's his field of expertise. But we're talking about when crime is committed in a community, why is it hidden? Why do you think it's hidden? You can let me know on 34519, or you can telegram me on 061-895-1019. That's telegram number. You can also give me a call on 01-01-403020. We are live today because my guest isn't located somewhere in a very different time zone. And Chad, just before we took those ads, I was asking you why we don't talk about crimes in the community.
I don't know. I find it to be very bizarre that people don't want to speak about frauds that have impacted so horribly on one another's lives. We had a case within the Jewish community a few years ago that involved a very well-known individual, and I can name him. His name is Michael Ash. It was in the Star newspaper, it was in the Northeastern Tribune, and it was in the South African Jewish Report. One week after another, it was one week in the one newspaper, next week in the other, next week the other, and people got backlash for that. Victims were re-victimized because they had come out to speak about the fact that this man had taken their savings, he had taken their inheritance, he had taken the proceeds from the sales of properties, and he had told them he was reinvesting it into various schemes. The one scheme he claimed was Steinhoff, and he used Steinhoff as a catastrophic event to claim that he couldn't pay people back when people started asking for their money. It later turned out that there was no investment in Steinhoff. He then claimed to have invested heavily with the president on a game reserve. There was no evidence of that presented. And later in conversation, it came out that he claimed that the money was used for high-risk loans to people who couldn't get loans in the traditional manner, and they would then pay back high interest, and he could then pay returns to the victims. Because his family was so well-known within the community, people didn't want to talk about it.
And such nice people.
And
it makes it very, very hard.
It does make it hard, but there was something that I experienced during that really upset me. I had a gentleman contact me who owns a shop on the strip, and he said, "Can I come see you about Michael Ash? I've got information for you about Michael Ash." And I said, "Come through, come visit with me." And he came through to our office and he said, "I got taken by Michael Ash 15 years ago." I said, "Oh, okay. And what has happened subsequently?" He says, "No, I realized it was a scam. I got my money back." I said, "When?" He said, "Oh, most probably about 12 years ago." I said, "Hold on a second. So you knew that this man was running a scam and you never told anybody?" He said, "Well, why should I have?" I said, "Because widows have lost their inheritance. Children have lost their inheritance. People have lost their savings. You're coming to tell me 12 years after you realize you were the victim of a fraud. Do you not think you could have helped those people?" And he didn't seem to find any fault in the fact. It was a case of, well, if he could figure it out, others should. And I think we have a moral obligation to protect one another. And if we know that something is wrong, we need to talk about it. And we shouldn't be criticized for it. And most importantly, victims shouldn't be re-victimized because they've come out to speak about the fact that some criminal has decided to take their money and change their lives forever.
So do you think that sometimes we just lose focus of what our goal is? If the goal is to protect the community, then you have to do whatever it takes to protect the community. If the goal is to protect the perpetrator, then those are the actions that you're going to do. You're going to, you know, help him get onto a plane, send him off to Israel, where he's going to continue, you know, there's four new cases against Michael Ash in Israel.
So how does one define the community? Well, the community should be defined as people who want to come together to improve the lives of each other in the best possible way. And that for me is so critical to understand, because somebody from that community decides to commit a fraud or to misrepresent facts or to do something, surely he's no longer a part of that community. Surely he should be taken out of that community. He should be shunned, because that person has taken that community and that community's trust and used that very trust that's created as a result of a community
against
and he's used it for his own selfish needs, and he's basically said to the community, "Well, thanks to the community relationship, I'm going to get away with this, because chances are you're not going to talk about it."
Well, it's the same thing with Tannenbaum, isn't it? He did the same thing with the community. That was another affinity, also Ponzi.
Also affinity, one of the biggest in South African history. There are moves at this point in time to have him brought back to South Africa.
Where's he living? Bandit Bay, I believe. What's it called? Bandit Bay in Australia.
So he's in Australia. He's there with a couple of other individuals that are also in the process of being brought back to South Africa.
Why has it taken so long to get Tannenbaum back? And will people ever get their money back?
Tannenbaum wasn't alone in his fraud. There were three individuals that were closely involved. Tannenbaum was the one who took the fall and whose name was used. He did not benefit to the extent that everybody thought he benefited.
Ponzi's don't, because you pay out.
We've got a chap sitting in Switzerland who benefited far more. And we've got another chap in Cape Town who allegedly benefited. So when it comes to Tannenbaum, it's a very interesting case, and it needs to be heard in open court. People need to know what happened. That damaged families, that damaged the community, and that created years and years and years of issues. And the clawback process was difficult. If one looks at the clawback process with the asset forfeiture unit, they've been very successful in other cases throughout the world where they've been able to find money. They've been able to claw it back through interim restraints and preservation orders. So if there is money to be found, it's not difficult. We live in a digital age. You can find out where monies have been transferred. You can follow it. We call it following the money thread or a money thread analysis. Why hasn't he been brought back yet? We have an extradition treaty. It was put to the test with Roger Stratton, who was involved in the Brett Kebble murder. And because he claimed in court that due to his health and due to the fact that our prison system was so macabre in that you could be assaulted, severely assaulted, you could be killed in prison, you may even be raped in prison.
You could contract HIV.
You could contract HIV as a result of that. The courts decided that he shouldn't be extradited to South Africa. And I think the South African authorities were a bit reluctant to initiate new extradition proceedings because they were nervous this would become case law in Australia. So our case law in South Africa is also very similar. We won't extradite somebody to another country if they face the death penalty, because our constitution doesn't allow for the death penalty. Australia doesn't allow for the death penalty, so they won't extradite somebody to a country with a death penalty. However, Stratton's attorneys argued so cleverly that it was tantamount to a death sentence to have him held in one of our prisons that they decided not to send him here. And Judge Cameron at the time, who was the inspector and for prisons, actually went on live. And it was one of the first times in South African jurisprudence history that we had somebody on screen in Australia in a legal proceeding live. And he said, as the inspector of the prisons, he finds that our prisons are fine. We have hospital wards, we have isolation cells, and there wouldn't be an issue, but the court still ruled against it. The NPA is taking another shot at extraditions of people in Israel, people in Australia, people in the United States that are on the wanted list. They're pushing for these extraditions to become paramount in terms of the way forward with the cases, to bring closure and restitution. But you must understand, our NPA has been incapacitated. It's been captured for a while. They're now recapacitating themselves. They've established the investigative directorate, but they're still having to concentrate on state capture cases, PPE cases, and tender fraud cases. It's trickling down. Then it's the corporates. Then it's the small and medium-sized companies. And then it's the individuals. So it's almost like a Maslow, but in the wrong sense of the word.
Yes.
You've got government at the top who takes preference, and you've got all the poor victims sitting at the bottom who can take years to see justice.
It's very sad. No, we need to find a way to turn that upside down, because somewhere along the line it did become turned upside down. You know, the government there is to serve the people, not the people to serve the government. And unfortunately, that's where we are in South Africa. But let's not digress. Is there a concept of privacy for criminals and perpetrators?
No, 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 no. And I'm saying no. There's case law in South Africa that if somebody is accused of a crime and there's a prima facie case against them, they can be named. They don't necessarily have to be charged in court. Everybody seems to think that you have to be charged in court to be named. That's incorrect. The case law is Modiri versus News 24 and versus the then Minister of Safety and Security, 2011. It was a full bench of the Supreme Court of Appeal that ruled that a suspect's details can be released if it's in the interest of the public. And I believe that scam artists have to be outed because it is in the interest of the public. Then, of course, people talk about Poppy. Poppy has exemptions. People talk about
Loshen Hora. We're going to get to Loshen Hora in a little while.
So let's talk about the law first before we talk about the tradition. So the law states in South Africa, we have a Supreme Apex Act, and that's the Constitution. The Constitution, Section 14, says you have the right to privacy. And it talks about you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, and you have to protect one's rights. But Section 36 of the Constitution talks about the limitations of rights. And that's why we have Poppy. Poppy has exemptions for fraud investigations. If you need to pull a profile on a suspect, the National Credit Act is where you find the legislation that pertains to consumer reports. It has exemptions. It allows for fraud detectors or fraud detection or fraud awareness reports to be pulled. So there are exemptions. There is no law in this country that is absolute. So even though Section 40 of the Constitution enshrines one's right to privacy, Section 36 of the Constitution says there's a limitation to rights.
Okay, you know what Loshen Hora is, Chad?
I do. I've been on your station for 8 years.
Not because we speak Loshen Hora, but because it has come up.
Because right? It's come up a few times, and I do try find the meaning of Yiddish terms, and trying to find out a lot more about how different communities tick. And I must be honest, it's a fascinating community. It's an incredible community. It's such a giving and dynamic community that it's very sad to see that this community, that size has dwindled over the years, has seen an increase of community members defrauding their very own community members.
Okay, so before we get to Loshen Hora, why is that? Why has it increased?
For the reasons I gave just now, the prosecution rates have been so low in South Africa, and the state has been forced to focus
on Jacob Zuma,
on the Guptas, on the others, that people at the bottom are not getting justice. And people see a gap. It's almost like a business opportunity. Oh, well, here we've got a failing criminal justice system. Let's take advantage of it. Let's show our entrepreneurial spirit and figure out a scam to make some money.
Okay, back to Loshen Hora. So Loshen Hora, if you don't know, it is a very loose translation is slander. You're not allowed to speak slander. It was put together by a rabbi that we call the Chofetz Chaim. What's so interesting about Loshon Hara is in chapter 10 of the Chofetz Chaim, you can actually just Google it online, there are certain conditions under which you are obligated to warn people. Now, firstly, I need to tell you that Loshon Hara is always true, right? If it's not true and it's an outright lie, then it's called something else. It's called Motzei Shemra. But Loshon Hara, the direct translation is like bad speech, right? But you have an obligation. So as an example, if somebody is going to enter into a marriage arrangement, right? Or they're going to get married to somebody, and you know something about that groom or that bride, you have an obligation to warn the potential spouse. There's a history of this. This is what happened, whatever. You have an obligation. The same is true for business. If somebody's going into business with somebody else and they've only ever done bad deals, you have an obligation to warn. But it becomes very difficult when people hide, and I think that a lot of people hide, behind this concept of Loshon Hara. You can't talk about it to me because of Loshon Hara. That's not true. You have to sit up and you have to take note, because otherwise you're going to get caught and you're not helping the community to protect itself. So tell me about your experiences with Loshon Hara. Do you agree with that, Chad?
I think that people have taken it out of context. They've misinterpreted it, or they've listened to somebody who themselves either misunderstands it or is deliberately misrepresenting it so that people won't talk about something. We had a client who became the initial complainant in the Michael Ash case, and we registered her case, which we escalated to the Hawks. And after that, when it was decided that the Hawks would be proceeding with the investigation, that there was prima facie evidence and the newspapers published, other people started coming forward, and we realized what was a 2 million rand fraud became a 10 million rand fraud, became a 50 million rand fraud, is now sitting at over 100 million rand fraud, and it was frightening. But what was really, really disconcerting was that that particular individual, the lady that spoke out about it, who had lost all of her money, began to be victimized. And people were saying, by the community, by friends and family of the accused. And she was victimized, and it was shocking. It was horrific that somebody could be treated in such a manner, who had lost so much, but was the first one who was prepared to speak out. After that, everybody started talking about it, and other victims came forward, but it took her bravery. Yet she was victimized and ridiculed for it.
How many people in that particular case?
Dozens.
Really?
Dozens.
And what's the amount?
I'd say it's close to, a fair estimation would be about 100 million.
And where's the money?
The money could be in South Africa, it could be in Israel, it could be in America. We know that there's properties, we know that certain funds went in terms of the money threat analysis, and we had a sensitive stage, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but we know that the monies did go into other people's accounts. And we know that he was protected by certain members of the community.
Okay, let's talk about this protection. There's a current case which you can't talk about, and I'm certainly not going to mention any names, unfortunately. I'm telling you that if you need to check the press if you haven't already heard about it. But what happens in some of these cases is that the rabbis get involved, and the rabbis will go to the victims and say, can you withdraw the charges? What's your thought on that, Chad?
So the case you're talking about, it's still been spoken about in hushed tones. It's a more recent case. And in that particular case, people have said, listen, why don't you give the guy another chance? Don't talk about it. Don't lay the charges. Let's see if we can arrange for the money to be paid back. Now, in other cases, I understand the fact that financial restitution is something that can be negotiated. In fact, our Criminal Procedure Act allows for it. If you do a 105A plea bargain, you can repay monies in terms of Section 297 or Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act. So financial restitution is allowed for. Mediation, arbitration is allowed for in terms of the Arbitration Act of 1965. And more importantly, last year, the Uniform Rules of Court introduced Rule 41A. So on a civil perspective, a case can be stood down for mediation or arbitration and a settlement can be reached. So in the past, if I said to you, listen, you need to pay back that money or you're going to be charged, it could be perceived as extortion in the criminal sense or compounding in the civil sense. Now the law allows for a mediated settlement to take place to say, listen, let's talk about this. Are you prepared to make reparations? And if so, we're willing to sign a non-disclosure, not go forward. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that. However, if the person is a habitual criminal and you know that this person is going to be stealing from Peter to pay Paul and continuing to do this, well, then I don't think you should be talking restitution in that context. I think you should be talking restitution as part of a far more severe sanction. For example, a disbarment if the person was a financial services provider plus the paying back of the money, or the disbarment of an attorney who dug into his trust account plus the paying back of the money. So I think the sanction needs to apply that it's not just paying back the money. There has to be something else, and that it's published so that that person can't do it to somebody else. These negotiations behind closed doors, listen, pay back the money and we're not going to tell anybody else about your bad deeds, that's not on. I don't agree with that.
Can a financial criminal ever be rehabilitated?
No.
Why?
It's just in their nature. It's part of the thrill. You asked me earlier what it is about a fraudster. Why would he do it?
The motivation, yeah.
And the motivation is lifestyle. It's obviously the money and what the money can buy. It's to show his peers that he's done better than they ever expected him to do. But also it's the thrill. It's that thrill of creating a scheme. It's that thrill of seeing that money landing. It's the thrill of seeing how you can convince people to believe in your elaborate scheme. So I don't believe that financial criminals can be rehabilitated. In fact, I've seen them reinvent themselves. I've seen them reinvent themselves and become evangelical church leaders. I've seen them reinvent themselves and become life coaches talking about their experiences when they were criminals. But they're using that exact same dynamic that they used to convince people to part with their money in a fraud to now part with their money in another scheme, and that scheme is to now lead them down another road of prosperity, either through the church or through their coaching exercises. It's quite unbelievable because it's a specific personality trait to be able to convince people to part with their money. And you see it all the time, that same personality trait time and time again.
So interesting. And something that's worried me for a while is how, as a community, and I'm sure that this happens in all other communities as well, how people with money are considered geniuses, brilliant, and should sit on boards. No matter how those funds were gained, it could have been through corruption, you know, through corrupt relationships. We saw it with the Guptas, right? The guys involved with the Guptas were sitting on school boards and shul boards. What would your criteria be then for people to sit on communal organizations? Because often it's the people with money who do, because we see them as successful, even though they might be horrible people, completely dysfunctional as parents. But if they have money, they're good to go. What's with that?
So Tenenbaum should have had generational wealth because his family were very successful within the pharmaceutical industry. He used that reputation to be able to further his fraud. You see that some people, there's an expression that I learned amongst the Jewish community. He's lucky his father was born before him. Yes. And Tenenbaum was one of those. He didn't have a clue. He wasn't going to make it, but he used his name and his connections that when he was putting forward that he had access to bring in product for the treatment of HIV in a bulk way, people believed it because he had engineered it to reflect on his family, on what his family were well known for, and they were well known in the pharmaceutical game. People that are entrepreneurs shouldn't be disqualified from sitting on boards just because they've made money and they're flashy. We can use those skills. we need to just understand that if somebody's making a lot of money in a very quick way, we should be asking questions. It's not that easy to make money anymore. It's not that easy in South Africa, especially. Our manufacturing capabilities, our mining capabilities are at an all-time low. We still have a handful of entrepreneurs who we can learn from. But other people want to go onto boards because they want to get that reputation as being somebody trustworthy. So the more boards they can claim they sit on, the more that people will believe them. And that's why we have organizations like the Institute of Directors, where if you have a non-profit or you have a board, you approach the IOD, and they have a complete program in place for directors, which is King's Four related, compliance related, ethics related. And what it does is they will find somebody suitable for that board or for that community who's been through a rigorous background as well as rigorous training. And a lot of companies are also sending their directors for training to organizations like the IOD.
I'm Kathy Kaler. This is Community in Conversations. My guest is Chad Thomas. We're talking about when crime is committed in a community, why communities hide it. We're focusing largely on financial crimes because that is Chad's area of expertise. But it happens with rape. It happens with pedophilia. It happens with domestic abuse. Why do you think communities hide it? You let me know. 34519 is the text line. Telegram, the number is 061-895-1019. Or you can even give us a call if you like. If you want to remain anonymous, that'll also be fine. The number to dial is 0101-403020. We'll be right back.
It's a community in conversation. Join Kathy Kaler every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 High FM.
And thank you so much for joining me this morning. My guest is Chad Thomas. He is the head of high profile investigations at IRS Forensic Investigations. And we are talking about when crime is committed in a community or by a community member, why does the community hide it? If the goal is to protect the community, then surely we should be warning the community. What's your thought on it? You let me know. 34519, that's the text line. You can also send me a telegram on 061-895-1019, or you can give us a call on 0101-403020. Got it? 0101-403020. We did ask you to weigh in. Carol's weighing in. She says, Kathy and Chad, it takes a lot to shock me, but I am sickened by the antics of these criminals, and silence is the enabler. Would you agree with that, Chad?
100%. Keeping quiet makes you party to it. Knowing what's going on makes you an accessory to it.
Yeah, Marion makes a very good point. She says, maybe people want to protect the innocent families. She says, no idea, but a thought. And I think it's a good thought. And I think that that's, you know, there's so much behind that, especially if the families don't know. There's also protecting the victims. In a case like pedophilia, you want to protect those minor children from being identified. It's a deeply personal event that can happen to somebody. So I do understand that.
So there's two sides to the coin. You want those children protected, but you also want them taken out of that environment. It's so very difficult, and it's so difficult to cross the line and to speak. In the case I mentioned to you earlier, the fraudster that targeted two families at a wedding and over the last couple of months has taken millions upon millions from them, the girlfriend became, it was almost Stockholm Syndrome. She became part of it, and she was too deep after going with him to casinos to now speak out about it. And she didn't know what to do. And it was very cathartic. It was a relief for her to be able to unbundle. And she wasn't sure how she was going to speak to her family. I said, you need to talk to them. They do know. They haven't told me they know. They haven't told you that they know, but they know that you knew. And with you being the one to come forward and to talk to them, there is going to be hurt. There is going to be tears, but they will heal. But they need to hear from you exactly what you knew and how long you knew.
What's happened with that case?
That case, it's a fairly new case. The research on the suspect shows that he's done this on a number of occasions. His own father turned his back on him 10 years ago, and the father didn't say anything, within the community. He took his father for between 20 and 30 million over a 2-year period, claiming to be funding, various business projects in the Laudium area of Pretoria. Meanwhile, it was going straight to the casino. He felt very sorry for the casinos. He thought he needed to donate as much money as he possibly could to the casinos. And of course, it was other people's monies.
Yeah, apparently spending other people's money is the way to go to a casino.
Yeah.
If you want to get in touch, 34519 is the text line, or 061-895-1019. That's 061-895-1019 on Telegram. You can also give us a call, because we are going to be wrapping up shortly. The number to call, 0101-403020. Chad, how do we protect the community? In your many, many years of experience, how do we protect the community?
I don't think the Jewish community knows how much respect there is for their community outside of the community. As somebody who's been an outsider and who's been welcomed into the community over the last 3 decades.
Oh, you're practically Jewish.
I'm still amazed at the way the community looks after each other and people talk about it. So, considering how few Jews are left in South Africa, the fact that people still talk about how Jews look after each other, how community orientated they are, it is something to be so very, very proud of. And therein lies this problem, because the Jewish community knows that they look out for one another, and they know that they want to try to solve their problems from within. And that's why, even when it comes to a divorce within the Jewish community, they don't really rely so much on the legalities as promulgated in the South African legal framework, but more on getting a get through the Beth Din. So there's this conditioning within the Jewish community that problems can be resolved within the Jewish community. And fraudsters rely on this. They're hoping that people are going to say, let's try sort it out. Let's talk about it. And while they're doing that, what they're not realizing is if they strike a deal with the fraudster for him to pay back the money, he needs to steal that money from somebody else within the community. And it just becomes worse, because eventually more and more people are targeted. And then people are going to say, but you got paid back, so you knew. You most probably got paid back with my money. What's going on here? And it becomes very, very destructive. So the community has to look out for the greater good of the community and not individuals within the community.
All right. Are there certain checks that we should check if we're going to be investing money, as an example, so at least we protect it from the financial fraud?
Hell yes.
Right. So, for example, if you are... And this was something that I actually took from speaking to you about one of the cases. If we get approached for advertising here on Chai FM all the time, right? And a lot of these companies are companies that sell Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. If you are not registered with the Financial Services Board, we will not take your advertising, because we have a responsibility to the community. Again, our goal is to protect the community. So every decision has to align to that. Right? So you spoke about Michael Ash. Was he an accountant? Was he registered with the Financial Services Board?
He wasn't registered. The Financial Services Board split in two. Mm-hmm. It's now the Prudential Authority, which handles public investments, such as blue chip investments on the stock market, and the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, which issues the FSP, the Financial Service Provider Number. No, he was not. Not just that, he was also in contravention of the Banks Act of 1990, because he was taking monies as deposits and he was purportedly paying interest on investments. So he was conducting the business of a bank as well as the business of a financial consultant. So what are the boxes you need to tick if you're going to invest with somebody? Well, first of all, understand their business model. If they tell you it's so complex and they want to invest your money and you don't understand what it is they're describing to you, do not invest. Do not invest. Because if they make it so complicated that you don't understand what's going on and you're just seeing dollar signs, there's something wrong with the scam. It's going to be a scam. I should have said there's something wrong with the scheme, because we refer to financial schemes. It's a financial scheme that's in actual fact a scam. So check the FSCA. You go to fsca.co.za. They have a open portal. It's free of charge. You can check to see whether a company or an individual is registered. Conversely, you can also see if a company or an individual is disbarred. If you're going to invest in an organization that is offering you a high rate of interest on a return. So in other words, you're not buying a retirement annuity, you're not investing in a long-term insurance product, but they're telling you they're investing your money and you get a monthly return. They're actually conducting the services of a bank. They have to be registered in terms of the Banks Act of 1990. You can also contact the Prudential Authority. You can contact Saab. All of these portals are available. What I find so very strange is that people come to me a day within Googling somebody and say, listen, this guy took me. I said, well, when did you take it? How did he take you? When did he take you? No, he took me 3 years ago. I said, but the post that you found on social media was 4 years ago. Why didn't you do your due diligence then? I didn't think it was necessary. I trusted him. So people are very quick to start Googling people afterwards. They're not doing their due diligence up front. And you know what? I hate this expression. I really, really, really do. But it's the expression that will always come up when somebody offers you incredible returns. If it's too good to be true.
It probably is. In fact, it always is. Absolutely fascinating. Moshe, you have to get hold of the studio if you want me to get the, you know, get the message. And that number is 34519 or 061-895-1019. You can also give us a call on 0101-403020. Gail, morning Gail, she says, good morning, Kathy. I was raised in a heavy, heavy religious home, and honesty was not ever considered or allowed to be mentioned. Self-righteousness was mind-boggling. Protecting the guilty was a must. Never allowed to speak the truth. That's from Gail, and that is one of the most tragic things because it goes against everything that I know Judaism and a relationship with God to be.
Sure, Gail, that was heavy.
God represents truth. How can we be lying? Am I missing the point?
You're not missing the point. What she just said there is so hard-hitting. It makes one realize what does go on behind closed doors. And people suspect, they don't talk.
Look at the time, Chad. We have to skedaddle. But before we go, I just want to say thank you very, very much, Chad, for making time, coming, sharing your knowledge. And as you've heard, sweeping the crimes of community members under the carpet is not unique to our community. That doesn't make it right. If the goal is to protect the community, which is what it should be, then we have an obligation to warn the community. When these crimes happen, we have to talk about it. It is not Loshon Hara. We are spreading the news around the community and warning the community. Whether it's a domestic abuser, a pedophile, a rapist, or someone involved in financial crimes, we have to warn the community. At the moment, what's happening is we are protecting the perpetrators. As a community, we also need to support the innocent family members and the victims who are caught in the crosshairs. But that is another conversation. I wish you and yours a Shabbat Shalom. God bless.